Jack will try to twiddle some knobs. Yes, I am. Okay. Let me add my welcome to Simon. It's good to see some new faces again this week. I think every week in the summer we've had people find us somehow. So welcome to you if you're new. Let me just reiterate what Simon said. We'd love you to stay around at the end and have some tea and cake. Please introduce yourself. And if you might be back, it would be a great help to us if you could fill in a welcome card just so we can be in touch with you. And we won't spam you. You'll get one email a week, but it will just help us to be in touch. So thanks very much. Please, can you turn to our reading for today, our main reading, which is Romans chapter 9. We are on page 945 of the Church Bible. Actually, sorry, 946, just over the page. What shall we say then? That the Gentiles who did not pursue righteousness have attained it, that is, a righteousness that is by faith, but the Israel who pursued a law that would lead to righteousness did not succeed in reaching that law. Why? Because they did not pursue it by faith, but as if it were based on works. They have stumbled over the stumbling stone. As it's written, behold, I'm laying in Zion a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense, and whoever believes in him will not be put to shame. Brothers, my heart's desire and prayer to God for them is that they may be saved, for I bear them witness that they have a zeal for God, but not according to knowledge. For being ignorant of the righteousness of God and seeking to establish their own, they did not submit to God's righteousness. For Christ is the end of the law for righteousness to everyone who believes. For Moses wrote about the righteousness that's based on the law, that the person who does the commandment shall live by them. But the righteousness based on faith says, do not say in your heart, who will ascend into heaven, that is to bring Christ down, or who will descend into the abyss, that is to bring Christ up from the dead. But what does it say? The word is near you, in your mouth and in your heart. That is the word of faith that we proclaim. Because if you confess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord, and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. For with the heart one believes and is justified, and with the mouth one confesses and is saved. For the scripture says, everyone who believes in him will not be put to shame. For there is no distinction between Jew and Greek, for the same Lord is Lord of all, bestowing his riches on all who call on him. For everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. How then will they call on him in whom they've not believed? And how are they to believe in him of whom they've never heard? And how are they to hear without someone preaching? And how are they to preach unless they're sent? As it's written, how beautiful are the feet of those who preach the good news. But they have not all obeyed the gospel. For Isaiah says, Lord, who has believed what he's heard from us? So faith comes from hearing, and hearing through the word of Christ. But I ask, have they not heard? Indeed they have, for their voice has gone out into all the earth, and their words to the ends of the world. But I ask, did Israel not understand? First Moses said, I will make you jealous of those who are not a nation. With a foolish nation I will make you angry. Then Isaiah is so bold as to say, I have been found by those who did not seek me. I have shown myself to those who did not ask for me. But of Israel, he says, all day long I've held out my hands to a disobedient and contrary people. Well, please keep that open. It's quite a dense chapter. Maybe as I was reading it, you thought, what on earth is going on? Especially if you're here for the first time and you haven't been following us the series through the letter. So I'm going to do my best to try and help us to get our bearings and to work out what's going on. But we are going to follow the argument quite closely. And so please have it open on page 946. And please also, you might find it helpful to look at the outline That model is printed for us on the inside of your service sheet. So if you open that, you'll see a couple of points. But the big question that Paul is addressing in these chapters is this: how come so many of the Jewish people didn't believe in their Jewish Messiah? And if Jesus really was the king, if he was the one long promised, then how is it that so many people who knew the Old Testament failed to receive him and accept him? Now, it might not be a huge issue for us nowadays. I guess if you were to go around London and looking for synagogues, you could find Jews worshipping today who believe in the scriptures, the Old Testament, and they don't believe in Jesus. And that ought to be a huge problem for you, but it probably isn't. I don't think I've thought about that recently. You probably haven't. But in the first century, it was a massive issue because these were the people that knew God and his promises. These were the people looking for a Messiah. And yet when Jesus came along, most of them said, no, this isn't the Messiah that we want. And so it gave Christianity a bit of a credibility problem. Is Jesus really the true king? And if so, how come so many people missed it? And in fact, you might even say, how do we know that Christianity is not a made-up, out-of-the-blue religion? We've got a Bible, you've got a Bible in your hands, hopefully, that has an Old Testament and a New Testament, and somebody has bound them together in the same book. But people of Paul's day would have been saying, well, look, this New Testament, this preaching about Jesus, it doesn't seem to fit with the Old Testament at all. Because how do we know? Well, the people who were the experts in the Old Testament aren't impressed with Jesus. And what's more, all of the wrong sorts of people seem to be becoming Christians. Just look at the verse, the first verse of our reading again, chapter 9, verse 30. What shall we say then? That Gentiles who didn't pursue righteousness have attained it. That is the righteousness that is by faith. But that Israel, who pursued a law that would lead to righteousness, did not succeed in reaching that law. Here's the irony. The people who were trying hard to please God, they had God's Ten Commandments, they had his moral instructions, they lived in a religious and moralistic way. These people didn't end up attaining salvation. But the shocker is that a load of pagans, people who worshipped all kinds of gods and lived in all kinds of sexually immoral ways, did end up believing it. So maybe Christianity isn't really an Old Testament faith at all. It'd be like taking a survey of people in church and saying, how come none of the morally upstanding people in Greenwich are members of the congregation at Grace Church? None of the people who are most respected, none of the people with the best positions in society, none of the people who are most scrupulous about keeping the law. And instead, this bunch of moral outcasts, people from all sorts of backgrounds. It looks like the wrong people are saved. So why is it that most of the Jews did not believe in their Messiah? That's the question, and it is a credibility issue when the gospel was first preached. Now, we had part one of the answer 2 weeks ago and 3 weeks ago. If you were here, it was the answer, you might say, from God's perspective in chapter 9. The answer was God never chose all of his chosen people. Sounds like a paradox, but the Jews thought of themselves as God's chosen people. That's what the Old Testament describes them as. But Paul points out it was never all of the chosen people that were chosen. Not everybody in the family tree was automatically in. So you take Abraham's family tree, and Isaac was in, but Esau was out. Isaac was in, Ishmael was out. Jacob was in, but Esau was out. God never chose all of the chosen people. That's a kind of God's perspective answer. In chapter 10, we get a human perspective answer. What was it that the Jews got wrong that meant they missed Jesus? And the answer is they got the law fundamentally wrong. Again, if you've been a Christian a while, if you're familiar with Christian things, you probably know that well-established Christian truth, that people are saved not by what we do, but by what Jesus has done. And we saw a little diagram of it in the kids' talk. Thanks, Simon, for that. The diagram of the big chasm between us and God. And sometimes people do the diagram, they try to put lots of things in the gap. So maybe we can fill the gap by what we do, by going to church or by saying our prayers. Or we've been looking at our series on the Reformation at some of the particularly Catholic ways of filling the gap, going to Mass or saying confession or praying to your favourite saint. And then the answer comes, no, there's nothing we can do to fill the gap. It's all about something Christ has done. People sometimes say, and the difference between Christianity and every other religion in the world is two letters. It's the difference between do something, and keep the five pillars of Islam, try to follow the path to enlightenment in Buddhism, try to live as a morally upstanding citizen, I guess is the atheist version, between do something and Christ having done something. Well, this chapter's a little bit like that argument, except it's much more nuanced than that. The Jewish people, they tried to attain righteousness by keeping the law, and Paul says that's a dead end, and there is a different way to be righteous. But actually, it's not the distinction between trying to keep the law and ignoring the law. It's actually two different understandings of the law. How are we supposed to understand the Old Testament and all of the commandments? And Paul says most of the people in Jewish history have got the Old Testament wrong. That's what the chapter's about. So here's the question at the beginning of chapter 10. How come all the people who were looking to attain righteousness didn't get it, but the people who weren't looking for it have attained it, a righteousness by faith? Well, here's the answer, verse 32. The Jewish people didn't succeed in reaching the law because they didn't pursue it by faith, but as if it were based on works. They stumbled over the stumbling stone, as it's written, "Behold, I'm laying at Zion a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense, and whoever believes in him will not be put to shame." Now, what Paul's done there is he's quoting from the prophet Isaiah, but he's combined two different verses into one. So one verse in Isaiah says this wonderful truth: whoever believes in him will never be put to shame. Here's this rock, and if you build your lives on this rock, you're never going to be put to shame. It's a wonderful promise. If you trust in Jesus, you're never going to be ashamed. But then Paul combines that with another verse in Isaiah that talks about tripping over a stone. And he makes it into one quotation. The same rock that can be the foundation for your life can also be the thing that trips you up. What is it about Jesus that trips people up? The idea that you have to trust in him. It's so weird, isn't it? It's not very obvious why that should be. It seems like such an easy thing to do. Here is the message of the gospel. Jesus has come as God's King. He's died on the cross to forgive us from our sins. He's rose from the dead on the third day. And all you've got to do is put your trust in him. If you put your trust in him, you will never be put to shame. It sounds so easy, so straightforward. And yet this very thing is what causes the Jewish people to stumble. It's almost like it's too easy for them. They want to be told something that they can do instead of trusting Jesus. They didn't succeed in reaching the law, verse 32, because they didn't pursue it by faith, but as if it were based on works. And so they stumbled. You probably know just from reading the Gospels that the Pharisees were fastidious about keeping the Jewish law. So they get very, very upset with Jesus at various points for doing things on the Sabbath, because Jewish people did nothing on the Sabbath. I've had the privilege of going to Israel three times now, I think, and on Christian holiday trips. And even modern-day Jews in Israel are fastidious in the same way. So there's special toilets, for example, that you don't have to flush, because obviously you can't turn a handle on a Sabbath because that might be doing work. And so as you go into the bathroom, this is seriously the case, there's a whole load of, or certainly in the boys' bathroom, there's a load of urinals, and then there's a last one that says this is the kosher one. This is the one that won't flush on Saturday. in case that would be counted as work. So just scrupulous to the nth degree. They had laws about carrying things, and they decided if you carried it above the waist, that would count as work. So light switches are an issue. You have to have special kosher light switches, which are down here, so you can turn them off without having to lift your hand. Otherwise, it might be work. There's exceptions. The rabbis made exceptions for doing things in your own house. And there's even parts of London where your house can kind of be extended into this zone by a little wire. And the wire runs around, you can miss it, but it runs around the lampposts. And it marks out an area that's kind of an extension of home. And if you're in that area, then it's okay. You can carry stuff. But as soon as you step outside it, you're leaving home and you can't. So just instruction on instruction on instruction. Scrupulous care to try to stay within the commandments of God. And even lots and lots of extra commandments invented by the rabbis. The Bible doesn't say anything about wires to make your house bigger or about light switches or automatic flushing toilets. But the rabbis created extra regulations just to make sure that they would scrupulously keep God's instructions. And to look at them, you think, here are people who really care about God. Look at how inconvenienced their life is by their desire to stay absolutely on the right side of God. And yet, Paul says, they missed salvation. They missed righteousness. Because the one thing they wouldn't do is to believe. It was too easy. Here's Jesus saying, just trust in me and you'll never be put to shame. And they were saying, no, what are we going to do? We can manage to do something ourselves to be righteous. And the idea that all it took was to believe, it was a stumbling stone. The same rock that could be a foundation for them was a stumbling stone. But then you might come back, you might not come back, but they would come back and say, but hang on a minute, Paul, surely we've got the Old Testament on our side. Because the Old Testament told us that we've got to keep God's law, and that's what we're trying to do. And instead, you've come along with this newfangled idea that all we've got to do is trust somebody. And what about all of the laws in the Old Testament that tell us we've got to do them in order to live? So just look at the beginning of chapter 10 and verse 5. For Moses writes about the righteousness that's based on the law, that the person who does the commandments shall live by them. That's actually a quote from Leviticus. It's not in quote marks, but it's exactly from the book of Leviticus. Moses writes about the righteousness based on law, that quotes, the person who does the commandments shall live by them. But the righteousness based on faith says, what if you can see the problem straight away? Can you see a problem in verses 5 and 6? Moses says, but the righteousness by faith, that the gospel, the Christian message says, Well, there you go, Paul. You see, you've just admitted it. Moses, who wrote much of the Old Testament, the first five books of the Old Testament, he says one thing, and your message says something else. So you've just admitted it. You're contradicting Moses. Actually, no. It seems that verse 5 is their favorite slogan. And he's quoting it back to them. Yeah, sure, Moses does say that the person who does the commandments will live by them. Yes. However, maybe you haven't read Moses in the right way. Let me show you what Moses really meant when he said this. Now, at this point, I wonder if you can keep a finger in page 172, or keep a finger where you currently are, page 946, and turn back to page 172. And this is quite tricky, so you're going to have to concentrate. Page 172 and page 946. So page 172, this is our first reading. This is the point where Moses is just giving the people all of God's commandments just before they enter the promised land. And this is what it says in verse 11. This commandment that I command you is not too hard for you, neither is it far off. It's not in heaven that you should say, who will ascend into heaven for us and bring it down, that we hear it and do it. Neither is it beyond the sea that you should say, who will go over the sea for us and bring it to us, that we may hear and do it. But the word is very near you. It is in your mouth and in your heart, so that you can do it. So just look at that reading. What is it that is not in heaven or across the sea? What is not in heaven across the sea, but right here with you? It is this commandment. So you can see how they read it. You say, look, you see, Moses is telling us it's not too difficult to keep God's commandments. It's not as if they're far across the ocean. It's not as if they're impossible to reach. They're here. You can do it. Verse 14. So you can see how that would have been read by a Jewish person. Now listen to how Paul reads this. And he seems to change the meaning. At first we might think quite sneakily. Moses writes about the righteousness based on the law. The person who does them shall live by them. But the righteousness based on faith says, don't say in your heart, who will ascend into heaven? That is to bring Christ down. Or who will descend into the abyss? That is to bring Christ up from the dead. What does it say? The word is near you, in your mouth and in your heart. That is the law, the commandment? No, that is the word of faith that we proclaim. So he's taken a passage in Deuteronomy about the law, and then he's made it about Christ. Well, now we're thinking this is even worse. So firstly we say, you're contradicting Moses, and Paul says, no, I'm not. And then he reads Moses in a way that just entirely reverses the meaning. You think, surely he's playing fast and loose with the Old Testament scriptures. That's how he's crowbarring in this believing in Jesus thing. But actually, no. Paul is just reading Moses in context. Back to page 172, where hopefully you have a finger. We picked up at verse 11. But actually, if you begin at the beginning of the chapter, this is what you discover, that God's people, Moses tells them, will not succeed in being obedient to him. They're going to be thrown off into exile because of their rebellion. They need to be changed from the inside by a miracle of God's grace. Moses says, chapter 30, verse 6, the Lord God will circumcise your heart so that you'll love God. There'll be a change on the inside so that you turn to the Lord with all of your heart and all of your soul. Moses said, you're never going to achieve it by what you do. Just start reading at the beginning of the chapter. He predicts your failure to climb the ladder, to be righteous enough for God. You'll never manage that. But then when you cry out to God for mercy, he will change your heart. A promise is given that somehow God is going to sort out the sinful human heart. And the way he does that is through the gospel. All Paul is doing is reading Deuteronomy chapter 30 in context. And he knows it's the heart that matters, not the commandments that you do, but verse 8, what does it say? The word is near you, in your mouth and in your heart. That is the word of faith we proclaim. Because if you confess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. See, this isn't a contrast between the law, Jewish people very concerned about it, and do whatever you want, but then ask Jesus to forgive you. That's not the contrast. The contrast is between the law apart from Jesus as something that you can do by yourself. I'll just try harder to be good. Paul says it's a dead end. It's a stumbling stone. Or the law is something that points you to Christ so that you come and trust in him in your heart. And actually that brings, Paul's already said in the book of Romans, that brings a transformation at every level of our being. Our hearts changed so that we are moved to want to obey God's law. The prophet said that the law of God will be written in our hearts. And Paul has said that the one who trusts in Christ ends up fulfilling the law back in chapter 8, verse 4. So the difference between the Jew who rejects Jesus and the Jew who accepts Jesus isn't that one of them cares about the law and the other one doesn't. It's that one of them tries to pursue the law by themselves apart from Christ. It's a dead end. And the other one comes to Christ and trusts in him as a foundation. And the law is written inside, in the heart. and so they're transformed. What I love about this chapter, I think the trouble with, always the Bible is a little bit more nuanced than us, isn't it? The trouble with the do and done thing, it's a nice little summary, isn't it? All other religions do, Christianity done. The trouble with that on its own is it makes it sound like it doesn't matter how you live if you're a Christian. Other religions want you to do something. Jesus doesn't want you to do anything. It's all been done for you. So just sit back, carry on living your own immoral life, and get a get-out-of-jail-free card. But that's not Paul's contrast. He's saying you'll never manage to obey God by yourself, but confess in your heart that Jesus is Lord, and you'll be transformed. That kind of faith in Jesus is saving faith. I love that the saving formula isn't just Jesus, my Saviour, but Jesus, my Lord. Everyone who believes in the name of the Lord, who calls on the name of the Lord, will be saved. And then Paul proves that. He proves it from Isaiah. The one who believes in him shall never be put to shame. See, Isaiah was all about belief. He proves it from the prophet Joel. We had it as our theme verse. Everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. It was in the prophet Joel. It's not that Paul didn't read his Old Testament. It's just that he read it in context. And the Jewish people didn't. Now, if you've got any Jewish friends, I mean, this won't be all of us, but if you've got Jewish friends, then actually the answers are in their own Bible, the Old Testament part of the Bible. They'll be reading the commandments saying, I've got to try and do this. But they're missing the promises that God makes to change us on the inside if we'll trust him, if we'll call on his Messiah. Well, we're almost done, but then Paul's argument has one more step. He says, given it's all about calling on the name of the Lord, well, people need to hear about the name of the Lord. He was there in the Old Testament. He was there in Isaiah and in Deuteronomy and in Joel, but people just missed him. So you're going to have to proclaim him. Verse 14, how will they call on him in whom they've not believed? And how can they believe in him of whom they've never heard? And how are they to hear without someone preaching? And how are they to preach unless they're sent? I was mocked a few years ago because I can't remember why this was, but for some reason we were in a group of people and we were giving each other foot massages. I don't know why that would be. Maybe it was reenacting Jesus washing his apostles' feet type thing. I don't know. But I was mocked because somebody said, I've got rather beautiful feet. And I don't think that's true. I've got knobbly toes. But actually, according to Paul, the person with beautiful feet is the person who brings the message of Jesus. How beautiful are the feet of those who bring good news? It's quite an interesting expression, isn't it? You think he'd say, how beautiful is the mouth of the person who speaks the gospel? But he says, how beautiful are the feet, because Paul wants people to travel using your feet, to go to somewhere where there's somebody who doesn't know about Jesus, and then to speak to them of Jesus, so that they can hear it and believe it. Is Paul saying then that the Jews never heard about Jesus and they need someone to go and tell them? No, he's not saying that. Verse 16, haven't they heard? Yes, they have. Actually, the Jews did know because they had Deuteronomy and they had Isaiah and they had Joel. They ought to have understood. I'm not talking about them. Paul's actually now saying this message is to go into all of the nations, because it turns out that if it's about trusting in Jesus and being transformed on the inside, then all sorts of people can be Christian. Not just the religious people who care scrupulously about being moralistic and religious, but even people like us. All sorts of people. And indeed, that's what God has done. Verse 30, Gentiles who didn't pursue righteousness, never even cared about the Old Testament, never even heard of the Old Testament, maybe, but heard about Jesus, trusted him, and ended up attaining righteousness. They had the law of God written on their heart. When they finally did discover the Old Testament and they started reading it, they thought, yes, I love this God, and I love my neighbor as it tells me to do because of the change in my heart. And look at the very last verse, verse 20. Isaiah is so bold as to say, I've been found by those who didn't even seek me. I've shown myself to those who didn't even ask for me. People from all sorts of countries who weren't looking in the Jewish scriptures for a Messiah, but ended up finding him through the message preached. But there's still an outstanding question. Has God finished then with Israel? Israel missed the Messiah. They tried to do it themselves. They stumbled. Is that the end? Well, come back next week for the next stage in the argument as Paul answers that.